On the program today, well, it's a little bit of everything, actually. Computer chips, mascara, and stationery. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the first day of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the economics of this increasingly tense geopolitical world. And the indicator we are going to use is ticker symbol NVDA. It trades on the NASDAQ and today fell 7.7%, more than 20% over the past 5 days. A drop that comes as U.S. computer chip maker NVIDIA, NVDA, right? Company revealed that Washington's not going to let it export certain high-end chips to China without special permission. And in filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission, NVIDIA said that it put $400 million in sales at risk. You throw that into the already burbling strategic stew that is Sino-American relations, and it's kind of a lot. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
The U.S. has been trying to cut off individual Chinese companies like Huawei from advanced computer chips for some time now. But this latest apparent move is new in that it appears to restrict selling to all Chinese companies. Chris Miller is associate professor at the Fletcher School.
The U.S. is hoping that by preventing China from accessing some of the most advanced chips, it will slow down Beijing's ability to apply computing power across its economy, but especially to its military systems.
The chips in question can be used to develop more advanced artificial intelligence and weapon systems. China's foreign ministry said the U.S. was, quote, stretching the concept of national security and abusing state power. Restricting sales of advanced computer chips to China carries practical risks. Adam Siegel is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
The concern for the U.S. semiconductor industry has long been that China plays a huge part in revenues. And if you cut off those revenues, then the tech companies can't invest in the next generation of technologies.
China could try and get these chips from businesses around the world that buy them legally. And for years now, China's been trying to hurry along its own chip-making capabilities. There is some risk cutting China off could accelerate that process, says Jordan Snyder at Rhodium Group.
That demand and those sales will be shifted elsewhere. So Chinese competitors are going to have their orders increased, which is then going to allow them to increase their R&D budgets and potentially get them to the technological frontier that NVIDIA is on faster.
Restricting the export of chips also has implications for Taiwan. Both the U.S. and China build many of their chips in Taiwan. And an open question is whether the U.S. will try and prevent not just U.S. companies from sending chips to mainland China, but foreign companies too. Paul Triolo is with Albright Stonebridge Group.
If the U.S. decides to, for example, extend those extraterritorial export controls to Taiwan, then that just adds to the pressure on the sort of U.S.-China-Taiwan relationship.
A relationship that is already increasingly tense. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the aforementioned NASDAQ was the loser, though not by much. Winners didn't win by much either, to be clear. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We got an updated read on labor productivity this morning from the Labor Department. The latest figures show productivity fell in the second quarter, 4.1%, less, actually, than a lot of people had been guessing. Manufacturing productivity went the other way, up almost 5%, and it turns out that in the second quarter of this year, American manufacturing was more productive than it was before the pandemic. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains what's going on here.
Productivity is a measure of how much stuff we make in a given period of time. So when manufacturing productivity goes up, that's a sign that we're making more goods. Jennifer Lee at BMO Capital Markets says consumers have been demanding them.
Even though a lot of people have switched to services in terms of travel and all that, there is still a hearty demand, I think, for goods. Autos, for example.
And in the second quarter, the amount of hours spent making all that stuff went down. That's because manufacturers have been struggling to fill open positions, says Chad Moutre, chief economist with the National Association of Manufacturers.
We're getting more work out of our existing employees.
Even though that also pushes up productivity, it's not what manufacturers want. Those existing employees have to work longer shifts. Moutray says worker shortages can also limit the amount of work manufacturers can do.
We did a survey in June that said that 45% of our manufacturing members have actually had to turn away work because they don't have enough talent.
But more recently, the sector has been getting some relief. Tim Fiore with the Institute for Supply Management says the supply chain's been easing up. Input prices are settling down and hiring is on the rise.
We're able to hire people again and get them on the factory floor. The quits rate seems to be diminishing a little bit.
As manufacturers put more people on the factory floor, they will have to train them first. Fiore says that can actually lower productivity in the short run.
Although you'd have a gain in hours worked, you'd have a loss in effective hours worked. Because even if you're training people on the job, that means they're taking a slower amount of time to get the job done.
But in the long run, more people means more output, especially since manufacturers have also been investing in their own factories in the meantime, says Jennifer Lee at BMO Capital Markets.
Businesses are still laying out more capital for their machines, for their equipment, for anything that lasts greater than 3 years.
Lee says if manufacturing productivity continues to rise, that's an encouraging sign for economic growth. I'm Justin Howe for MarketWise.
There's perhaps nothing as fleeting as trends in this economy that come and go and come and go and come and go on social media, TikTok and Instagram mostly. Viral dances, challenges of one sort or another, and product reviews as well. And then when a certain curling iron or cleaning product or condiment catches on, the brands and businesses that make and sell them really only have a limited time to capitalize on the, let's face it, short attention span, no offense, of a whole lot of social media users. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has been spending some time on social.
The great mascara sellout of 2020 all started with one video from a little-known TikTok creator named Jess.
I just wanted to show you guys the difference. Look at that.
Jess is in what looks like her bedroom testing Maybelline's Lash Sensational Sky High Mascara. The video looks like a spontaneous product review, raw and unpolished. She even accidentally smears makeup all over her eyelid. But her lashes look impressive, and soon other TikTokers are testing it out too.
So we're going to see if the Sky High mascara actually works as well as people say it does.
You guys have been asking me to try this. You've been tagging me. I couldn't find it anywhere.
It's so good.
Today, videos with the hashtag SkyHighMascara have nearly 650 million views on TikTok. Most of them feature that original video uploaded by Jess. And despite what it looks like, she was not some random person reviewing a random product. Jess was one of a few hundred creators the company paid for content. Tina Liu is a marketing director at Maybelline.
So oftentimes, it's really letting them have the product, making sure that they know the key features and benefits about it. And then you kind of have to leave it to the creator to showcase the product in a way that their followers are going to resonate with.
Like a lot of brands, Maybelline has been spending more on social media marketing each year. It now spends more than half of its ad budget on digital media, which means increasingly what you see on TikTok or Instagram aren't spontaneous trends, but intentional advertising. Jonah Berger is a marketing professor at Wharton.
A lot of times we think it's random luck or chance. We think we have to catch lightning in a bottle. Some companies get lucky and some companies don't.
Sure, TikTok marketing looks different from TV ads and magazine spreads, but Berger says its unpolished appearance is part of what makes it so appealing. Virality also depends on whether the content feels useful, the product is accessible, and if the video is easy for other users to copy.
Suddenly now you're part of an ongoing discussion that's happening online. And so in a lot of cases, once something gets a little bit of traction, then other people are doing their own riff on it.
Virality is hard to plan for, even if you're a big company like Maybelline. Its mascara campaign exceeded expectations. You might say sales were sky high. Over the first few months, the product sold out 4 times at the beauty chain Ulta and became the best-selling mascara that year, selling 10 million tubes. Lou says it put Maybelline in a supply chain crunch.
We were meeting almost every day at that point, just to try to find solutions.
Like shifting some of their manufacturing lines to make more mascara. Thankfully for Maybelline, it manufactures its mascara in the U.S., so it didn't get stuck on some cargo ship in the middle of the ocean. But sometimes virality is not capturable, like that moment in 2021 when, for some reason, everyone on TikTok was baking feta cheese. Benoit Brielle is the owner of Saxelby Cheesemongers, a wholesale retailer that supplies around 80 stores and restaurants in New York City.
It was a feta cheese surprise. We suddenly got a lot of orders for feta in the middle of winter.
Feta is popular during warmer months, on fresh salads with cucumbers and tomatoes, and demand was mysteriously triple what it usually is. Brielle was confused.
And, you know, it takes a few days, so we were able to understand what was going on, and we missed most of it.
Brielle finally saw the trend on the news. By the time he coordinated extra orders with his suppliers, he missed a whole week of the feta craze. And a couple weeks later, it was over. Brielle says, unfortunately for him, that's just the nature of his business. Social media trends can expire as fast as some of the cheese he sells. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Envelopes are the hardest thing for us to get in right now.
Can't mail a card without them. Am I right? But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrials picked up 145 points today, almost 0.5%, finished at 31,656. The NASDAQ down 31 points, a little over 0.25%, ended things at 11,785. The S&P 500 rose 0.3%, 39.66. Bree was telling us about chips and chip makers. Well, here you go. NVIDIA, we mentioned, down 7.75%. Advanced Micro Devices down almost 3%. Seagate Technology Holdings subtracted 1.6%. Intel, the OG of chip companies, I think anyway, gave up about 0.5%. Discount retailer Five Below is rolling out a new concept with higher price points called Five Beyond. Clever, right? Shares picked up more than 6.25%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus rose 3.26%. Thank you, Jay Powell. You are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, while the trend in equities the past 3-4 weeks has been down, day by day, stocks have been kind of choppy, a little bit bouncy, volatile, you might say. And Wall Street being Wall Street, there is a way to trade on that volatility. The Chicago Board Options Exchange, the CBOE, offers something called the Volatility Index, the VIX, to those in the know. Marketplace's Lily Jamali explains what it can and cannot. Tell us about the market.
While many of us keep an eye on major stock indexes, Vanderbilt's Robert Whaley also tracks the VIX, sometimes called the fear gauge.
I watch it every day, and it tells me how worried I should be about my pension fund and my ability to retire at some point in the future.
Whaley developed the VIX. He says he came up with the formula after analyzing all the S&P index option prices ever recorded on the Chicago Board of Options Exchange. That was 3 decades ago, and he says the VIX is still relevant.
I think it's an accurate reflection of how people are feeling, because that number is computed using real dollars.
Dollars investors are paying to insure against more ugliness in the stock market. And the VIX measures that. They pay more if they're worried.
The amount you're willing to pay for insurance is directly dependent upon what you believe is going to happen in the future.
5 years ago, the VIX made news for not moving much, says UBS's Luke Kawa.
In 2017, for instance, when market volatility was just quite low for a very long time, the VIX was quite low for a very long time.
Volatility came roaring back in early 2018. Fast forward to these last few months, the VIX is moving a lot again at levels that are considered high.
What the VIX is saying right now is that, hey, we're not in a risk event, but we're in a bit of a economic macro malaise.
But the VIX has its limits, says RSM's Joe Brusuelis.
It doesn't tell us a lot about where valuations are going, or really much about the economy.
An economy that right now is rife with uncertainty. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
According to the American Public Transportation Association, which is, yes, Big Transit's lobbying group, public transportation use is still down about 40% from the before times. It's relevant to note here that fewer Americans were getting on public transit even before the pandemic hit. By 2019, bus ridership nationally was at levels not seen since the 1970s. One of the few places that had been bucking that trend, though, was Seattle. Last decade, the city actually reduced the share of commuters who drove alone to work by almost 10% by making huge investments in buses and light rail. Before March 2020, the Seattle area was an example of how to do transit right. So how's it going now? Marketplace's Matt Levin got an all-expenses-paid trip to the Pacific Northwest to find out.
It's about 4 p.m. on a Tuesday afternoon in downtown Seattle, where Sherwin Lee stands at a bus stop on 2nd Avenue. 3 days a week, Lee waits for the 550 Sound Transit Express to take him home to Bellevue, a rich suburb about 15 miles east of the city where lots of tech workers live. Like Lee, he's a data scientist for a software company.
Yeah, this is us, so...
Lee flashes his transit card, they call them orcas up here, and pretty easily finds a seat, something he's still getting used to.
Yeah, so this route actually was very regularly what we would call crush loaded, just packed to the gills before the pandemic. And before COVID, it would run probably about every 5 minutes or so.
Now the 550 runs every 10 minutes and the bus is maybe 80% full?
Yeah, I'm not going to complain about getting a seat, although, of course, you know, transit works best and most efficient when it's packed.
Lee loves transit. He moonlights as a rider for a local transit blog. He could afford to drive into work, but he prefers the bus, making him what Mark Hollenbach calls a choice rider.
And they are choosing whether they are going to drive down I-5 in the awful rush hour congestion and pay $30 a day or $300 a month for parking in downtown Seattle and work at Amazon.
Hollenbeck researches transit at the University of Washington. He says Seattle was a success story last decade because it made that choice easy, building dense housing around light rail, ramping up rapid bus lines. But now those choice riders like Lee have a new choice.
Telecommuting.
In February 2020, 1.3 million people took the type of express commuter bus Lee uses. That number is down by half. Weirdly, though, it's not as if car traffic has gotten that much better. Because of the basic human need to leave the house after a day of nonstop Zooming, Hollenbach says afternoon rush hour is actually worse.
You have everybody who's out shopping. You have everybody who is going out for recreation. You have everybody else who's doing all of these other things.
Cece Hooks luckily misses most of that traffic on her bus commute into the city. She works the graveyard shift, but it's still a schlep.
It's about an hour and 5 minutes, depending on traffic. If it's traffic,
we're at the park and ride in Lakewood, a far-flung suburb about 40 miles south of downtown Seattle. She works as a dispatcher for the county bus service, makes about $24 an hour. Ridership in the region's lower-income suburbs remains pretty strong. That pattern is true in most of the country. For those that can't telecommute, the bus is a more affordable option than driving, and sometimes a more peaceful one.
Well, I have an Orca card from work, and it pays for me to go to work. I don't want a lot of gas mileage on my car, and I have road rage sometimes.
Local bus systems are adjusting to shifting demand. Express commuter routes from richer suburbs have been trimmed, and they're trying not to touch routes in lower-income areas. But there's another mode of transit that's recovering much quicker. On a Thursday afternoon, Yair Cantero and his partner Lissa Clear are taking Link, the Seattle light rail, to Lumen Stadium, where the Seahawks are about to host their first preseason home game. The car is pretty packed with football fans.
This is the first time we use it, and man, they told us that we should ride the, what do you call this,
the
light rail. So we decided to try it out, and it is way more affordable than parking at the stadium.
Ridership on Link is nearly back to pre-pandemic levels. That's mostly thanks to riders like Cantero hitting up sporting events or restaurants or running errands, not commuting. There are plans to triple the mileage Link covers in coming years. In Seattle, I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Hey, so is it just me or was everyone in like Italy and Greece this summer? I mean, maybe it's just my Instagram, I don't know, but summer, even as it wanes, means tourists, international and domestic, which also means busy, busy times for retailers. We've got some retailers we talked to. Annie Lang Hartman is one of them. She owns Wild Letty. That's a stationery and sundries shop hard by the shores of Lake Michigan.
Foot traffic, honestly, I think it's been down a little bit. So compared to last year, it is down. But as someone that has lived in this area all of my life, it seems just like another busy Leelanau summer. So I think in the grand scheme of things, it's been another great year as far as tourism in Leelanau County. We are very thankful that we have not run into many supply chain issues. Unfortunately, envelopes are the hardest thing for us to get in right now. There's a 2 to 3 month lead time, so we are hoping that we are not going to run out before we get those in stock. Staffing is good heading into our quieter fall season as far as retail. I like to set our schedules for everyone in March or April for the entire busy season, so everyone knows where they're working and what times they're working. Heading into the fall and winter, we're doing pretty good on the small team of four that we have. I think right now we're really just focusing on regrouping. Once Labor Day hits, tourism definitely drops. It's still busy on the weekends for us, but it kind of just feels like we get to exhale a little bit. I'm very excited to clean our office space and get things reorganized and just kind of hit a reset button before we really gear up for holiday season. I am already designing and getting manufacturing lined up for products for next summer and even next fall and winter already. So that is what Wild Letty has going on right now.
A dispatch, if you will, from Annie Lang Hartman running Wild Letty in Leland, Michigan. This final note on the way out today, in which I borrow liberally from my colleague David Brancaccio, who on our morning show this morning was talking to one of his regulars, Diane Swank, chief economist at KPMG. The topic at hand was jobs, the report on job openings earlier this week, and the monthly jobs report due out tomorrow. And I figured, as I heard it this morning, I could paraphrase it this afternoon, but, you know, why? So let's roll the tape.
I think the JOLTS data was July. We'll get August unemployment in the morning. We have to be a little bit careful of that data.
Exactly. Now, the unemployment rate should be okay, but the survey response rates in the month of August, especially for the payroll part of the survey, are the lowest of the year. And so we often get a false read and have to take anything we get in the month of August with a grain of salt until revisions are done, because it can be the largest revised month of the year. So whatever number we get, we have to be careful how we interpret it, because many companies just don't respond in the month of August, and that often skews the data.
I mean, you get that, right? Companies not answering the phone in August? I get it. Diane Swank, chief economist at KPMG, on the Marketplace Morning Report this morning, to which, by the way, you should obviously listen. All right, here is your moment of economic context, of a theme, actually, with Diane Swank and the jobs data coming out tomorrow. I figure it's helpful to mention this every couple of years, and today, I have decided, is the day. When you hear that jobs report tomorrow morning, remember that it's got a margin of error, confidence interval for the statistics people among you. And for the July report, the 90% confidence interval on the number of jobs was plus or minus 120,000. For the unemployment rate, it's plus or minus 0.2 percentage points. Amir Bibawe, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.